Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 4th. I'm your reader, Wanda Sanderson, and here's our first story. University of Nebraska-Lincoln facility makes protein that could be used to treat severe cases of COVID-19 by Julie Anderson. With the novel coronavirus case counts still rising globally, researchers are searching high and low for treatments, sometimes in their own laboratories. Officials with the University of Nebraska and Lincoln College of Engineering facility, in fact, were working with a company to develop a combatant protein for another use when the coronavirus struck. The company, which is involved in drug discovery, determined the protein could be used to treat the effects of the coronavirus, said Dennis Henson, project manager with Biological Process Development Facility. The protein would not be a cure, but could provide an option for people with advanced cases of COVID-19 to either prevent the need for or reduce the time on a ventilator, said Scott Johnson, the facility's production manager. Henson and Johnson said they could not identify the protein or explain how it functions because they have a non-disclosure agreement with the unnamed drug firm. However, the hope is that the protein could reduce some of the inflammation that can cause serious effects in some patients. The next step for the company will be to conduct safety testing in animals. That testing must be completed before the firm could seek approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for clinical trials in people. They're wanting to go as fast as they can, Henson said. If everything goes well, you're looking at late July, probably August, for the first in-human testing. The facility's job is to make a lot of the protein and to do it in a way that meets the safe manufacturing practices required of a product intended for use in humans. Working toward a possible treatment for the novel coronavirus as the pandemic continues, is particularly rewarding, Hansen said. It's exciting, he said. Staff here can see the problem and know that they might be able to have a hand in producing something that will really make a difference. That's the kind of thing you want to do when you go to work, to make a difference. Carter Lake community members come together to honor 2020 graduates. Dozens of Carter Lake residents paid tribute to the 2020 graduates from their city with the dedication of a row of banners honoring them Tuesday in front of Carter Lake City Hall. The banners will remain on display for 2 weeks in front of the city's Reflections of Honors Eagle sculpture facing Locust Street. After that, they will be given to the families. I'm very happy the way it turned out, said Risa Putnam, who led the committee that organized the project and raised the money to have the banners printed. It's been an emotional time for Putnam, whose son, 2020 Abraham Lincoln High School graduate Rylan Trowell, wasn't expected to live long enough to graduate from high school, she said. My son was hit by a car at 4. She said, doctors told us he would never survive, and if he did, he would never graduate. And now he's graduating. Each banner features a photo of a graduate against a backdrop of school colors. The words, "Congratulations, 2020 graduate," appear above the photo, and the student's name is given below. The group includes Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and St. Albert's High School, and homeschool graduates, plus a couple who moved to Carter Lake from Omaha and finished high school in their former communities, Putnam said. We're from all over, and we come together as one community, she said. Diane Terry, who homeschools her daughter, Samantha, also liked the banners. Samantha said homeschooled children are sometimes overlooked, and she was glad to be included in the play. I love it, said Dawn Tarbox, a committee member whose daughter, Ellery, was one of St. Albert's graduates in the group. This lady, Putnam, has worked countless hours getting this done. I'm just proud to be on the committee. Planning for the project began in April after Council Bluffs Community Schools announced that there would be no in-person graduation ceremony. Committee member Kibi Kessler said, the school district now plans to have in-person ceremonies on June 20th at Wickersham Athletic Complex. Putnam got the idea for the banners from a Facebook post she saw for another community that did something similar to honor its graduates. She then formed a committee which included Melissa Renshaw, Alyssa Pradholm, and Kayla Fay, along with those mentioned above. The committee decided to include all seniors regardless of school, Kessler said. We counted up 49 seniors, but only 44 would respond to us, he said. Putnam had families email photos of the graduates to Anytime Tees where the banners were printed. We went door to door looking for our stragglers, she said. We had a photographer on our committee who offered to take free pictures, so we were able to get pictures that way too. It's been amazing, Putnam said. We've had a lot of support, especially from the city with its contributions. The city provided stakes where the banners could be hung and paid for 19 of the banners, according to Putnam and Kessler. Anytime Tees donated a banner that simply said, Congratulations, 2020 Seniors. Kim Kazimierczak, who was principal at Carter Lake Elementary School when the 2020 graduates were in preschool through fourth grade, was glad to see them moving on to bigger and better things. We're really proud of them, she said. Kazimierczak said she wasn't surprised to see Carter Lake come up with a way to honor its graduates. Carter Lake has such a pride in their community and their school, she said. Auditor's Office. More than 1,200 Republican absentee ballots remain out, by Mike Brownlee. The Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors Republican primary election Tuesday night had one clear-cut winner, with two candidates neck and neck for the second spot in the November general election. Tuesday night ended with Brian Shea in second place in the race with 2,635 votes per unofficial results, narrowly ahead of Adam Hauser, who had 2,614 votes. Christy Everett with the Pottawatomie County Auditor's Office that said there were 1,247 Republican absentee ballots that had not come in as of Wednesday afternoon. I'm not expecting to get anywhere close to all those, Everett said, noting that they had to be postmarked by June 1st. But with 21 votes separating Shea and Hauser, it seems it's too close to call the race at this point. Supervisor Tim Wichman finished with 3,517 votes and will move on to the general election, which will also include Democratic challenger Lisa Lima, who was unopposed in the primary and received 4,969 votes. Wichman was followed by Shea and Hauser, with Mitch Kay coming in fourth with 2,464 votes, followed by Don Derricks in fifth place with 2,032 votes. Everett will canvass the election to certify results at the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday. Pottawatomie County Sheriff Lieutenant Andy Brown has a clear path to replace retiring Sheriff Jeff Danker. Brown finished with 3,415 votes, defeating Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office Chief Deputy Rob Ambrose, who received 2,588 votes, and the Sheriff's Office Deputy Danielle Bensinger, who received 1,732 votes. "The votes are in, and we came up short," Ambrose said in an election night Facebook post. "My family and I would like to thank you all for the support you have shown us during this process." On Facebook Wednesday, Bensinger said, "As you know by now, we didn't get the results we had hoped for. While the tally is disappointing, our campaign and our efforts was not. We fought the good fight, ran a clean race, and I'm very proud of that. I am also proud of all of you, the support, encouragement, and love of what kept me going through the ups and downs that a campaign brings. I appreciate all you so much," Bensinger said. The Democratic primary featured about 1,200 write-in votes. In her post, Bensinger said if she was voted for enough to garner the Democratic nomination, "Please know that if that happens, I will not accept the nomination and I will not continue the campaign into November. I ran firmly as a Republican and will not pivot party platforms for political gain. At this point, please join me in congratulating and supporting our new Pottawatomie County Sheriff, Andy Brown," Bensinger said. On Wednesday, Ambrose said that with 35% threshold of the nominee, "I am assuming nobody got that many in the Democratic primary. But if he were to win the primary," he said, "no, not at this time, of plans to pursue it." Everett said her office hasn't counted all the write-in votes yet. She did note there were a lot of the Mickey Mouse votes and stuff like that. Ambrose said, "I'm at the same place of an independent run in November." A message for Bensinger about an independent run was not immediately returned Wednesday evening. Currently, that's not an option. The Iowa legislature recently passed a law that requires political parties, including third party parties and independents, to submit nomination papers in late winter or early spring, per Iowa political blog Bleeding Heartland. The blog reported the Libertarian Party of Iowa has filed a lawsuit challenging the law. Previously, third-party candidates and independents had a filing window in the summer after the primaries. With all that said, a note of correction clarification: in Tuesday's, a photo caption noted Brown is replacing Danker. Brown will currently run unopposed in November, and while it's likely he'll replace Danker, nothing is set in stone until the general election. County Auditor Melvin Hauser won an uncontested Republican primary with 6,927 votes. There were no nominees in the Democratic primary. All local state legislature primaries were uncontested. Senator Dan Dawson, who represents the 8th District that includes Carter Lake and much of Council Bluffs, took the Republican nomination with 2,902 votes. Democrat Steve Gorman will challenge him after winning his primary with 3,250 votes. House District 15, 16, and 22 include Council Bluffs, Carter Lake, and most of the remainder of Pottawatomie County. In District 16, Brent Segrist and Jen Pelland won the Republican and Democratic primaries, respectively, and will face off in the general election to replace retiring Republican Representative Marianne Hanusa. Segrist received 1,761 in the Republican primary, while Pellant received 1,750 in the Democratic primary. Representative Charlie McConkie won the House District 15 Democratic primary with 1,491 votes. Sarah Abdu will challenge him after winning the Republican primary with 1,076 votes. The House District 22 Representative John Jacobson received 3,884 votes in the Republican primary. Challenger Shauna Anderson will face him in the fall after winning the Democratic primary at 1,944 votes. Pottawatomie County reports 7 new COVID-19 cases, explains discrepancies between county and state numbers by Mike Brownlee. 7 Council Bluffs residents have tested positive for COVID-19, putting the number of cases in Pottawatomie County at 316. Pottawatomie County Public Health said the new cases include 3 individuals that are 18 to 40 years old, 2 that are 41 to 60 years old, and 2 that are 61 to 80 years old. The individuals were tested between May 22nd and June 2nd. They noted that according to the state, 3,438 residents have been tested. Pottawatomie County Health reports that 316 have been tested positive and about 92% tested coming back positive. The county noted that the state COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, lists 275 positives in the county, with the reason for the discrepancy in part tied to the timing and fluidity testing and reporting. County officials have some tests are reported directly to the county, which informs the state, which for some tests, the opposite is true. Another reason for the inconsistency is EpiLinking, the department said. PCPH is accounting for and assisting epidemically tested, EpiLinked individuals. An individual can be EpiLinked if their physician or PCPH assumes they have the virus based on close contact with a confirmed case and demonstration of COVID-19 symptoms, the department said. EpiLinked cases are not confirmed by laboratory testing. PCPH includes EpiLinked individuals in their monitoring process and offers them assistance and guidance as they recover. Additionally, PCPH conducts contact tracing on EpiLinked individuals. The state of Iowa does not account for EpiLinked cases in their official numbers. PCPH began EpiLinking cases on May 16th and has worked with a total of 30 EpiLinked cases so far. Additionally, 11 county residents have recovered from the disease, bringing the recovery total to 180. Currently, 5 individuals are hospitalized, down from Tuesday, and 115 individuals are self-isolating. The county said 92 cases are the result of community spread. Pottawatomie County Public Health said it continues to conduct contact tracing investigations for each COVID-19 case, noting that if and when a risk to the general public is identified, it will publicly identify the location and communicate all any actions the public should take. The county has said daily, because we have community spread of COVID-19, individuals should continue to take precautions to protect themselves. Stay home as much as possible, limit travel and shopping, and practice social distancing. Wash hands and disinfect surfaces multiple times per day. If you're sick, stay home. A test Iowa site is open in Council Bluffs at the Western Historic Trail Center, 3434 Richard Downing Avenue. Anyone wanting to get tested must first complete the health assessment at testiowa.com. After completing the assessment, the individuals will receive a time and date for their test. The state saw an increase of 256 cases and 13 deaths. The percentage of positive tests dropped to 12%, with 168,783 Iowans having been tested. There have been 12,135 recoveries in the state after 357 new recoveries were reported. Monona County, the hardest hit area the Nonpareil has tracked, saw 10 new cases. There have been 540 cases in the county out of 2,058 tests for a positive percentage of 26.2%. There have been 333 recoveries in the state. Editorial. Our view. Steve King had lost his and the state's voice in Congress, a loss that cost him his House seat. Steve King, the lone Republican in Iowa's U.S. House delegation, lost his bid for a 10th term in Congress on Tuesday. A fixture of the Iowa political scene since his election to the Iowa State Senate in 1996, and a lightning rod on the national political scene since his election to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2002, King lost to a well-funded state senator, Randy Feenstra, in a five-way GOP primary. Known for making incendiary comments about immigrants and white supremacy over the course of his nearly two decades in Congress, King was shunned by his party's leadership in Washington and many of his longtime supporters in Iowa. King was stripped of his committee assignments last year for comments appearing to question the criticism of white nationalism in an era of heightened sensitivity among Republicans nationally about the alt-right and white supremacists. As the Associated Press reported, King wondered aloud in a New York Times story about when the term white supremacist became offensive. Remarks, he argued, were taken out of context. The remarks caused an uproar, which the New York Times reported resulted in Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican majority leader, telling King to find another line of work. All four of King's opponents on Tuesday's GOP primary campaigned as equally conservative as King on issues like abortion and gun rights, but they promised more effective representation of the district after King lost his committee assignments. King served on the Judiciary, Agriculture, and Small Business Committees until January of 2019, when he was removed from all committee assignments following bipartisan condemnation of his remarks on white supremacy. King's loss of his Judiciary Committee cost him an opportunity for a high-profile role defending President Donald Trump during the impeachment hearings last year. Likely more telling in his loss Tuesday was the loss of his seat on the Agriculture Committee while representing an Iowa district that, according to federal data, produces more agricultural products in raw dollars than any other district but Nebraska's massive third district. I personally felt very let down about some of the things that have happened because we need someone who is strong in agriculture from this area, said Senator Annette Sweeney, a former King supporter, told the Associated Press. King, who had a well-deserved reputation for speaking his mind on virtually any topic about which he was asked to comment, had, for all intents and purposes, lost his and the state's voice in Congress, and the loss of that voice cost him the election. Universal takes first steps reviving Orlando theme park biz. With masks on their faces and temperature checks at entrances, Harry Potter fans and roller coaster lovers stream back into Universal Orlando's resort this week in one of the first major steps toward reviving Florida's theme park industry, which was left temporarily moribund by closures to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. Universal Orlando became the first of Orlando's major theme park resorts to reopen by allowing annual pass holders to return to its three parks Wednesday and Thursday. It will open to the general public Friday for the first time since mid-March. "We miss the parks desperately," said Donna Walters, who wore a pink scarf over her mouth and nose Wednesday after walking past a security checkpoint where a guard took her temperature with a thermometer gun. If her temperature had been 100.4 degrees, 38 degrees Celsius or greater, she would have been barred from entry under new virus-related procedures adapted by Universal Orlando and the area's other theme parks. The number of people allowed in was restricted to allow for social distancing. Blue circles on the ground showed visitors where to stand to maintain 6 feet, 2 meters distance, and a recording in English and Spanish played in a loop over loudspeakers at the entrance, reminding park goers to wear face masks and keep their distance. Workers with spray bottles and cloths wiped down the handrails of flat escalators leading into the parks and city walk, the resort's restaurant entertainment complex that has been open for more than 2 weeks. "We feel like all the precautions were up to snuff. We felt super safe to come here," said Walters, who, as a nurse, is accustomed to wearing face masks. "Yeah, the mask. It's Florida, so it's hot. But it is what it is, and it does protect other people." Crosstown, rival SeaWorld Orlando, is set to reopen next week, and Walt Disney World plans to welcome back visitors next month to its parks. Both theme parks resorts are adapting similar safety protocols as Universal. On Thursday, SeaWorld-owned parks in Tampa, Busch Gardens Tampa Bay, and Adventure Island announced they plan to open next week. All of Florida's theme parks temporarily closed this spring, and Floridians and theme park fans across the U.S. were forced to stay home because of state and local lockdown orders meant to stop the virus spread. The smaller Legoland Florida resort in Winter Haven, Florida, opened Monday. "It's refreshing to be out here because you spend so much time cooped up and in quarantine. It's cool to be out in the open," Gonzalez said. "You're so used to high-fiving people and getting the character meet and greets, but you can't do that now, obviously, because of social distancing." You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Roger Elwood Bush, B-U-S-C-H, passed away May 29, 2020, and was born July 2, 1937. Roger was preceded in death by siblings Harold, Arlene, Donald, Bernice, and Raymond. He is survived by daughter Charlotte, husband Scott Zeluf, Z-E-L-U-F, son Scott Bush, and significant other Carol Hall, and sister Marilyn. Services will be held on Saturday, June 6, 2020, at Faith Lutheran Church, 2100 South 11th Street, Council Bluffs. Visitation will be 11 a.m., and the funeral service will begin at 10 a.m. Graveside following the funeral service at Graceland Park Cemetery, 4720 South 42nd Street, Omaha, Nebraska. Irene L. Beck Dawson, age 90, passed away on May 29, 2020. Born March 14, 1930, Irene loved ballroom dancing and camping and hiking in the Rocky Mountains, starting at a very young age. She worked at a Montessori as a Montessori teacher of 3 and 4 year old children. She was a member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church and a volunteer with the Pottawatomie County Geological Society. She was an avid researcher of genealogy and a huge Cubs fan. Irene graduated in 1948 from Abraham Lincoln High School and married Everett J. Dawson on February 9, 1952. She started teaching in 1968 at St. Paul Episcopal Montessori School. Later, she worked and owned Montessori Children's House until retirement in May 1994. She is preceded in death by her husband, Everett J. Dawson, parents Herbert and Florence Sutton Beck, brothers Herbert V., Robert, and Bernard Beck, survived by daughters Nancy, husband Terry Kratch, K-R-A-C-H-T, of Crescent, Iowa, Diana Dawson, husband Kevin Johnson, of Kalaupai, Hawaii, Janice, husband Dave Hallstrider, of Lincoln, Nebraska, brother Harold Beck, of Council Bluffs, grandchildren Carolyn Hendricks Yule, husband Russ Yule, Sarah, husband Greg Rathbun, Josh, and Zach Hallstrider. Great-grandchildren, Kirsten and Jaden Hendricks, Easton and Maya Yule, UHL, Addison and Dawson Rathbun, step-grandchildren, Michael, wife Elizabeth Johnson, Michelle, husband Jacob Strong, step-great-grandchildren, Aiden and Louise Johnson, Jackson and Jordan Strong. Private memorial service Saturday, 1 p.m. The service will be live streamed, accessed through the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home website. Earl L. Charlie Hodswalker Jr., Hodtwalker, age 72, of Council Bluffs, passed away May 29, 2020, at his home. Charlie was born June 2, 1947, in Lincoln, Nebraska, to the late Earl L. and Florence Kederer Hodswalker. In addition to his parents, Charlie was preceded in death by his siblings Ron, Eleanor, Eugene, Teresa, Michael, and Dale. Charlie is survived by his son, Earl, wife Samantha Hodswalker III of Grand Rapids, Michigan, 2 grandchildren, Zach and Adriana, siblings Ada, Gary, Randy, Francis, Wilma, Minna, Florence, and Richard, many nieces and nephews. Visitation with family Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Graveside service and burial will follow at Ridgewood Cemetery. Kenneth K. Hummel, H-U-M-M-E-L, age 95, passed away June 1, 2020 at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Ken was born July 22, 1924, in Oakland, Iowa, to the late William and Gladys Turnell Hummel, and graduated from Oakland High School. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Army from 1943 to 1946 and participated in the Battle of the Bulge as a tank driver. Upon his returning from the war, Ken was united in marriage to Peggy B. Corr on August 24, 1947. To their union, they were blessed with three daughters, Christy and twins Jeanette and Lynette. Ken served on the Council Bluffs Police Department for 9 years and spent many years in the real estate business with companies such as Harry C. Crowell and Heartland Properties. He is a member of First Christian Church, life member of both the VFW and American Legion, veterans of the Battle of the Bulge, and an Optimist Club member for over 42 years. In addition to his parents, Ken is preceded in death by his wife, Peggy, infant brother, Norman, brothers, Harry, Elwin, Jack, and Don, sisters, Glenda, Veraldine, Marjorie, and Rilma. Survivors include daughter, Christy, husband, Greg Hoover, of Council Bluffs, twins Jeanette, husband Steve Gunther of Raytown, Missouri, Lynette, husband Tom Flood of Frisco, Texas, 6 grandchildren, Jason, wife Jill Hoover, Abby Smith, Brent, wife Cindy Flood, Sean, wife Kaylee Gunther, Joel, wife Stephanie Gunther, Kyle, wife Alyssa Gunther, 17 great-grandchildren, many nieces and nephews, visitation Friday, 5 to 8 p.m., funeral services Saturday, 10 a.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel, interment Oaklawn Cemetery, Oaklawn, with military rites by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Funeral service can be accessed live streamed on the funeral home website. Memorials to First Christian Church and Optimist Club. Charlene Nielsen. Our community has lost an incredible woman on May 19, 2020, when Charlene June Nielsen peacefully went to be with the Lord. Charlene was born in Kansas City, Kansas on July 24, 1938. To Raymond Preston and Nellie Mae McDaniel Robinette. Charlene loved big B-I-G, and everyone around her felt it. She was an amazing mother to her 7 children, Ron Franks, Rhonda Kephart, Randy Franks, Ruth Parker, Renine Underwood, Robin Franks, and Christy Farnsworth. Charlene has left behind an incredible legacy that includes 19 grandchildren, 43 great-grandchildren, and 5 great-great-grandchildren. She has touched countless other lives. We will be hosting a celebration of life later this summer. Sports. Lynx looking to make big strides in first year under Koch, K-O-C-H, by Patrick Donahue. Ryan Koch era officially commenced Tuesday when the Abraham Lincoln softball team took the field for its first practice of the season. Numbers are high, as is the girls' excitement after the season was delayed due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. So far, we have about 34 kids signed up, Koch said. Our numbers are great, but we're going to be young. Of our 34, we have 18 of those girls that are sophomores and below, and a bunch of athletes. We've had a couple of volleyball girls come out. I think they're looking to get out and play something. We've had some kids from other sports showing some interest to get out there and play. So we've had some other athletes. The Lynx were young last season, finishing with a 7-26 record and a 4-8 showing in the Missouri River Conference. They lost three senior starters, but return a slew of talent, including freshman pitcher Holly Hansen, who started 31 games, throwing 160 innings with a 5.49 ERA with 112 strikeouts in 2019. As an eighth grader being thrown out there, she had to learn adversity right away, Koch said. She wasn't overpowering people, but she was throwing strikes. She learned to overcome that adversity of things not going her way or teammates not making plays. She's always been calm, cool, and collected with all of that. Just her poise that she shows on the mound as an eighth grader, she's just going to grow. There's a tremendous upside to that in what Holly can do for us. Other leaders expected to step up for the Lynx include senior second baseman Sydney McCorkle, who has garnered interest from Iowa Western, and speedster Alexis Carruthers, junior catcher Sierra Beeman, and center fielder Maddie Anderson Trotter, and sophomore shortstop Emma McNeil are also expected to contribute. As excited as Koch is to see his team on the field this year, he knows it's also important that they follow state guidelines for the safety of everyone on the field. They want to set a precedent for how sports in the fall, winter, and beyond can compete safely. I think it's important for all of us to show the state that this can be done and that will help with their fall sports and winter sports, Koch said. If we prove that we can follow those guidelines and keep kids safe, then it's going to show the state that these other sports can play as well. He also thinks his squad has the potential to take a large step forward. I have high expectations for them, Koch said. We have some really good athletes that can contribute to all facets of the game. I think we have the potential to finish in the top three or four in the conference. I think we're going to surprise some people just with the athletes that we have. We've had more athletes come out, and when you have those, they can contribute in ways that they don't even realize yet. There's tons of potential to make some noise in the conference. We're real confident. We know we have a pitcher that can throw strikes, and if we put the girls in the right positions to make the plays, and they make the plays they're supposed to make, I think we can really compete this year. Johnny Majors, former Tennessean pit coach, dies at 85. College Football Hall of Famer Johnny Majors, the coach of the Pittsburgh's 1976 National Championship team and former coach and star player at Tennessee, died Wednesday. He was 85. Majors died at his home in Knoxville, according to his wife, Mary Lynn Majors. He spent his last hours doing something he dearly loved, looking out over his cherished Tennessee River, she said in a statement first given to sports radio WNML. Majors compiled a 185-137-10 record in 29 seasons as a head coach at Iowa State, 1968 to 1972, Pitt, 1973 to 1976, and 1993 to 1996, Tennessee, 1977 to 1992. That followed a standout playing career at Tennessee, during which he finished second to Notre Dame's Paul Hornung in the 1956 Heisman Trophy balloting. He was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1987. Tennessee retired Majors' number 45 jersey in 2012. Dynamic on the field, fierce on the sidelines, distinguished Tennessean, Tennessee's football program tweeted, "We mourn the loss of legendary player and coach Johnny Majors, a man who left an indelible mark on Tennessee football. Majors starred for the Volunteers from 1954 to 1956 as a single-wing tailback and punter, and twice was named the Southeastern Conference Player of the Year. He went on to a successful coaching career and had his greatest year in 1976 when he led Pittsburgh to a national championship with a team featuring Heisman Trophy winner Tony Dorsett. He was more than just an integral part of my college football career. He was a dear friend who continued his relationship with me far beyond my playing days," Dorsett said in a statement. "He took a young high school kid and showed him how to be a leader and a man. My prayers are with his family, the Pitt community, and all the players and coaches who have been a part of his life. Rest in heaven, Coach." During the 1956 season, Majors rushed for 7 touchdowns, threw 5 TD passes, and punted and returned kicks while leading Tennessee to a 10-1 record and Sugar Bowl appearance. He finished his Vols playing career with 1,622 yards rushing and 1,135 yards passing. He proved even more successful in the coaching ranks, where his coaching tree included Jimmy Johnson and Jackie Sherrill in his first staff at Iowa State. Majors gave John Grunder, currently coach of the NFL's Raiders, his first job as a graduate assistant at Tennessee. Gruden said Majors taught him what football is all about. "He preached that loyalty and hard work are the staples to your success," Gruden said in a statement. "The amount of players he touched over several decades is endless. He was a heck of a football coach, a great competitor, and truly embodied what Tennessee football is all about. We lost a great, great man, and I will miss him dearly." Majors began his head coaching career in 1968, at Iowa State. 3 years later, he led the Cyclones to their first bowl game bid in school history. He posted a 24-30-1 record at Iowa State from 1968 until 1972, before Pitt hired him away. Majors was born in Lynchburg, Tennessee, and grew up there in nearby Huntland. His father, Shirley Majors, was a longtime football coach at the University of the South in Sewanee. The young Majors was an assistant coach at Mississippi State and Arkansas before becoming a head coach. His death came 2 days after that of former Auburn coach Pat Dye, who died Monday at the age of 80. Majors went 4-5-2 against Dye, including a 38-20 upset of then number 1 Auburn with Bo Jackson in 1985, when Majors was the SEC Coach of the Year. Virus morning update. White House fears protests could lead to virus insurgence. For weeks, President Donald Trump has been eager to publicly turn the page on the coronavirus pandemic. Now, fears are growing within the White House that the very thing that finally shoved the virus from center stage, mass protest over the death of George Floyd, may bring about its resurgence. Thousands of Americans, many without protective face masks, have jammed the nation's streets over the past week in defiance of social distancing guidelines from governors and the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. The White House Coronavirus Task Force, which has dramatically scaled back its operations as states reopen their economies, is scrambling to track the potential impact on infection rates. Any uptick in cases in the weeks ahead could slow the economic rebirth that Trump's advisors believe he needs before he faces voters again in 5 months. 1.9 million seek jobless aid, even as reopening slow layoffs. Nearly 1.9 million people applied for U.S. unemployment benefits last week, evidence that many employers are still cutting jobs, even as the gradual reopening of businesses has slowed the pace of layoffs. The total number of people who are receiving jobless aid rose slightly to 21.5 million, down from a peak of nearly 25 million 2 weeks ago, but still at a historically high level. It shows that scattered rehiring is offsetting only some of the ongoing layoffs that the economy mired in a recession. Thursday's latest weekly numbers for the Labor Department are still more than double the record high that prevailed before the virus outbreak. Still, the number of people who applied for benefits last week marked the ninth straight decline since applications spiked in mid-March. The job market meltdown that was triggered by the coronavirus may have bottomed out as more companies call at least some of their former employees back to work. Economists said they were disappointed, though, that the number of first-time applicants for jobless aid and the total number of people receiving benefits remain so high. While the drop in new claims is welcome news and more evidence that the worst of the job issues are behind us, the recovery in the labor market is expected to be painfully slow, said Gregory Dacko, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. We look for a two-phase recovery, with an initial burst in rehiring followed by a much slower retracement of job losses. Fewer people sought jobless aid last week in 47 states and in Washington, D.C., while the number rose just in California, Florida, and Mississippi. The total number of people receiving aid fell in 37 states and in D.C. and increased in 13 states. Applications for jobless benefits are falling in states that have reopened their businesses early, such as Georgia and Texas, and are also declining in those that are still early in the reopening process, such as New York and Massachusetts. Some businesses that have reopened have seen only a limited number of customers so far. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, Nelka Gione lost her job as bartender at a whiskey bar when it closed in March. Though the bar has reopened, it has rehired only two of its 17 employees. Meanwhile, Jaoma is receiving $275 in state unemployment benefits each week, plus $600 a week in federal benefits. We are honestly so blessed by that, she said of the federal aid, which will expire at the end of July. I wouldn't have been able to get by on $275. Still, she is eager to return to work and go back to school in the fall to finish her college degree. Yet, she always regarded bartending as a long-term opportunity. I always thought I could work in hospitality forever, she thought. I thought it was recession-proof. In addition to the laid-off employees who applied for benefits last week, 623,000 others sought jobless aid under a new program for self-employed and gig workers who now qualify for unemployment benefits for the first time. These figures aren't adjusted for seasonal variation, so the government doesn't include them in the overall data. And 15 states still aren't reporting the number of applicants under this program, meaning that the data is incomplete. The figures come one day before the government's job report for May is expected to show that employers slashed 8 million jobs last month and that the unemployment rate jumped from 14.7% to 19.8%. If those forecasts prove accurate, it would mean that nearly 30 million people have lost jobs since the viral outbreak intensified in March and that joblessness has reached its highest point since the Great Depression. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.